told me she was planning to go away that weekend with her kids, but said she'd be willing to do it if Clinton could not. I called back later, when I still hadn't heard from Clinton. "People think we need someone out there," I said. There was a pause. "What about Hillary?" "She doesn't want to do it," I said. She laughed. "So I'm it?"
"Looks that way."
"Okay," she said. "I'll do it if you do my prep." I sat at my desk and put together a document to help her prepare. It took only a few minutes. I merged the different Q&As that our press team already prepared for Jay Carney's daily briefings, since she'd be getting the same questions, and I listed some objectives up top to make the document feel like more than a repurposed set of press guidance. One of the questions we'd been getting was whether the protests across the Middle East showed that our foreign policy was a failure. So one of the objectives I listed was to show that the protests were rooted in the internet video, not a failure of U.S. policy. I never could have guessed how these few hurried minutes at my desk would become one crucial link in the chain of a massive conspiracy theory. I went home. Anne, still reeling from the death of her father, was frustrated with me for being absent. She was taking things out of cabinets and cleaning them, the kind of thing she did when she wanted to distract her mind and keep me at a distance. I stared at my BlackBerry, catching up on things I'd missed in the crush of events. There was an email chain about what talking points people should be using to describe what happened in the Benghazi attack. There was a deputies committee meeting the next morning, as there had been every morning that week, about how to deal with the various issues, embassy security, the internet video, the collapsing world. We'd also have to give Susan updated points for her to use on the Sunday shows. I wrote back and said that we could just deal with this at the meeting. I was standing in the closet so Anne wouldn't snap at me for being on my BlackBerry. This was the last thing I wanted to be doing. At the deputies' meeting, we spent most of our time on updates to our security posture at embassies, one country after another. Mike Morrell was on via video conference from CIA headquarters. When the issue of the talking points on the Benghazi attacks came up, he cut off the discussion, saying that he would rework them and send them around for use. I was grateful. One less thing to do. A little while later, we got an email from Morrell with the revised points. I made one edit, changing a reference to our consulate in Benghazi, since it was not a consulate. After the meeting, I left to do some errands with Anne, who was now barely speaking to me because of my long hours. We got the car washed and then went to the Calvert Woodley liquor store on Connecticut Avenue. While she was inside, I sat in the car and joined a phone call to prep Susan for her Sunday show appearances. At first, the campaign staff was dialed in, but I kicked them off the call before Susan could dial in. We couldn't have them brief a National Security Cabinet official. I walked Susan through the likely criticisms from Netanyahu that she'd have to respond to, mostly demands that we be tougher on Iran, tougher on the Palestinians. We went through all the security measures that we were taking at our diplomatic facilities, and then went through the various criticisms of our foreign policy that she'd be asked about. On the question of what happened in Benghazi, I told her we were lucky. The CIA had prepared points for this purpose, and I'd send them to her to use. Later, after I got home, I forwarded the points to her press aide to pass on. That was that. Sunday morning, I had to go back into work for more meetings. Protests had spread to places as far-flung as Paris and Sydney. The crisis prompted by this internet video was going to be with us for a while. Susan taped her Sunday shows, but I was in the Situation Room at the time. I never did see a single one of those appearances, though I read the transcripts that were sent around by our media monitor on my BlackBerry and thought that, all things considered, she'd done a good job. I left work early that afternoon, hoping to have a few quiet hours. Chapter 15. A Second Term. Debate preparation took place at a resort in Henderson, Nevada. As the motorcade made its way farther out from Las Vegas, past where people actually lived, We went by a strip mall that sat empty like a 21st century ghost town, a relic of the financial crisis. Even though this first debate was on domestic issues, I was the national security staffer assigned to the trip. I passed up the opportunity to sit in on the prep sessions, choosing instead to go on long runs on the surrounding golf courses, emptying my head while jogging down fairways baked brown by the desert sun. The hotel where we were staying had a Middle Eastern theme, with an arabesque lounge, Moroccan patterns, and a signature cocktail called the Casablanca. I'd sit in the air-conditioned, empty lobby, sedated by this American creation of an idealized Arab world. Each night, Jon Favreau would emerge from the debate prep sessions more and more nervous. Obama was flat, irritable, and long-winded. Favreau was notoriously anxious in campaign seasons, riding what he called a polar coaster of emotions, checking the daily tracking polls, always anticipating the worst. But he also knew Obama in a way that only a handful of us did. And it turned out he was right. After 3 days in Nevada, we flew to Denver, where Obama was thoroughly beaten in a debate with Mitt Romney. A group of us watched backstage on a television screen as Obama came across as somehow diminished and annoyed by criticisms that he found unfair. He had been cruising to re-election, so the debate offered a turn in the media narrative. Suddenly, Obama was on the ropes. In the days that followed, Obama had small groups of us into the Oval Office. "That one was entirely on me," he said. "It won't happen again." To buck up Obama's spirits, I made a list of 10 other times that things looked terrible over the last 6 years. When we were down by 20 points to Hillary, Reverend Wright, Palin's high point, Scott Brown's election, the 2010 midterms, the debt ceiling. He loved this and called me up to the Oval to go over it. "I wasn't really that stressed about Palin," he said. "I don't remember that. Maybe she got to you." "That hockey mom thing worked for a little while," I said. "What was the worst?" "The debt ceiling," he said, and looked momentarily pained by the memory. "Because that one wasn't just about me. A lot of people could have been hurt." The second debate would be a town hall format in which selected audience members asked screened questions after they're called on by a moderator. An exact replica of the debate stage was built at a golf resort in Williamsburg, Virginia, right down to the color scheme, red carpet, star-spangled flourishes along the curved exterior. For 3 days, we sat in the audience seating that circled the debate stage, pretending to be real people asking questions of Obama and John Kerry, who was playing Mitt Romney. Obama would practice an answer, and then we'd critique his performance. "Get into it faster. Look at the person who asked the question. Don't forget your home base." At some point, Obama, who liked to name the absurdities of politics, snapped. "I get it," he said. "So this isn't really a debate at all, it's just a performance." He asked that we just write up the best answers he could give on key questions, drawing on the best answers he gave in debate prep. One of the questions was on Benghazi. In practicing an answer, we had to tell him about all the conspiracy theories gaining traction on the right. Obama had been on a news blackout, so he didn't believe it. "Do people really think this?" he asked. "It's all over Fox," I said. "This is some real tin hat stuff." One of the theories was that we'd refused to call what happened in Benghazi terrorism and had invented the connection to the internet video to make his record on terrorism look better. "I'm telling you, it's all over Fox," I said. I explained how he'd called it an act of terror the day after the attack, then Susan Rice had said the attack developed out of protests over the video, then the director of the National Counterterrorism Center had testified that it was carried out by Al-Qaeda-affiliated extremists. Susan's reference to protests, which had been a part of the intelligence community's talking points, had been seized on by the right. "How exactly is it a cover-up if we're the ones who told people that it was terrorism?" he asked. "Just explain that to me." "And what were we covering up?" It was something he did, acting as if you believed the crazy things that you were telling him. "Don't think too much about it. It will make your head hurt. He practiced his answer on Benghazi and kept saying, "I stood in the Rose Garden the next day and called it terrorism." When he finished, I spoke first. "No," I said. "Remember, you called it an act of terror." "What's the difference?" he asked, annoyed. "Trust me," I said. "Act of terror," Favreau repeated. He got better as practice went on, more comfortable in approaching the debate as a performance. We flew up to Hofstra and did one more practice run at a pair of lecterns in the lobby of a hotel where we had a few hours to kill. "I stood in the Rose Garden and called it an act of terror," he said, looking at me and Favreau, over-enunciating the word terror, to make the point that he got it and thought it was ridiculous, this distinction between terror and terrorism. Then he went up to his room to eat dinner, and I went to the bar and drank bourbon. We were nervous. A good debate, and he'd be on a path to victory. A repeat of Denver, and he'd be in trouble. As the debate got underway, Obama was clearly stronger. About halfway through, the Benghazi question came, and Obama launched into a version of the answer he'd practiced. Romney pounced. "I think it's interesting the president just said something, which is that on the day after the attack, he went into the Rose Garden and said that this was an act of terror." "That's what I said," Obama responded. Romney looked surprised, even shocked, at his good fortune. "You said in the Rose Garden the day after the attack, it was an act of terror? It was not a spontaneous demonstration. Is that what you're saying?" Obama was now the one who looked pleased. "Please proceed, Governor," Obama said. "I want to make sure we get that for the record," Romney said, "because it took the president 14 days before he called the attack in Benghazi an act of terror." "Get the transcript," Obama said. "What an idiot," Favreau said, as we watched this unfold on a television backstage. Candy Crowley, the moderator, confirmed that Obama was right. Romney looked indignant, then deflated. He just knew that Obama had not called it an act of terror. Sitting there, half drunk and delighted, it nonetheless unsettled me a bit that Romney, an intelligent man, really did seem to believe something that wasn't true. You could almost see how his debate prep had gone, a group of aides who'd been feeding on a steady diet of Fox News preparing him to pounce on Obama for refusing to call it terrorism, for inventing a story about an internet video. I assumed they were just cynical. What if they actually believed this stuff? On election day, a small group of us were invited to the Obama suite at the Hyatt as it became clear that he would win. Me, Jon Favreau, Dan Pfeiffer, and Cody Keenan, who was slated to take over as chief speechwriter after Favreau left. We clustered a tactful distance across the room from where the Obamas were gathered with a group of family and close friends, watching the results on television. Because the election was called earlier than anticipated, the room had the feeling of a low-key party. There was a spread of appetizers, wine and beer, 30 or 40 people scattered about. Obama made the rounds, talking to the different clusters of guests like the groom at a wedding. Michelle Obama presided over the family area, offering hugs to all who approached her. When Obama came over to us, he looked more relaxed than I'd seen him in a long time. "In some ways, this one is sweeter than 2008, he said. 2008 was pretty good, Pfeiffer responded. "This one feels better, he said. Folks know you pretty well after 4 years. As I looked over at Malia and Sasha, now grown into teenagers, it occurred to me that the anxiety any president feels about being rejected by voters must have been magnified for Obama because he was the first African-American president. You don't want to be the first and be deemed a failure. I wondered how much some of the occasional irritability that had flared up over the last few months was tied to this. As the night dragged on, Romney refused to call and concede, even though it was obvious that he had lost badly. Finally, as it was getting closer to midnight, Obama stepped out of the room to take the call. When he came back in, he had a look of both amusement and surprise. "He kept talking about how many urban voters turned out," he told us. "Urban voters." From the window of Air Force One, Burma unfolded below, a mysterious expanse of river, rice paddies, and unspoiled green dotted with the occasional small village. It was less than 2 weeks after the election, and Obama was about to become the first American president to set foot in this distant country. We landed at a small, dilapidated airport in Yangon. Air Force One felt too large for the surroundings. As the motorcade turned onto the airport access roads, we were greeted by row after row of schoolchildren waving flags. At first, the sight of these smiling young faces was reassuring, but as their identical uniforms stretched on, the authoritarian choreography felt a little chilling. Where were we? Then we reached the main road and the crowds swelled into the tens of thousands, most in T-shirts or wrapped in Buddhist robes, mothers and fathers with their children, people as far as you could see. The crowds pressed in against the motorcade whenever it slowed, people smiling, cheering, staring in wonder at something they never believed they would see. A few years before, people weren't allowed to gather like this in public. It felt as if the place we were visiting was changing in some intangible way just through the fact of these crowds. Isolation ended, an expression of hope. We drove to Aung San Suu Kyi's home, a white house nestled against a lake where she'd been imprisoned for nearly 2 decades. We parked the limousine in a driveway adjacent to her front veranda, where she stood waiting for us. She showed us into a small room filled with trinkets that she'd received over the years. A picture of Gandhi rested on the shelves alongside well-worn paperbacks. She had a striking face with deep, dark eyes and black hair with streaks of gray and a flower in it. I sat in a chair along the wall while Obama, Hillary, and Suu Kyi sat around a round table, each of them still icons in their own way. "We've made progress, but this is still a country with many problems," Suu Kyi said. "The young people have very high expectations, and of course we don't want to let them down." She spoke at great length, without interruption, winding around points, describing relatively obscure parliamentary maneuvers. Hillary had told us that she takes pride in being a politician now, and that was clear. Obama rested his cheek on his hand and listened. While offering support to the Democratic opening, he asked her about the troubling situation facing the Rohingya people in Rakhine State, an ethnic minority that was confined in part to displaced persons camps. "This will be very difficult," she said, referring to efforts to improve conditions there. "Of course we believe the human rights of all people in Burma must be respected." Later that day, Obama gave a speech at the University of Yangon. The university, once a center of opposition to the military junta, had seen scores of students beaten and killed in the protests that followed Suu Kyi's victory in the 1990 elections, which were annulled. The school had been shut down for many years and was being reopened for the speech. While Obama spoke, I roamed the corridors, examining the dilapidated building. Inside, the crowd, unaccustomed to watching political speeches, sat in silence until some tentative applause started to build at certain points toward the end, when Obama talked about the need for reconciliation. Obama also affirmed the dignity of the Rohingya, a name that was rarely spoken aloud in a country where a large majority of people denied that the Muslim ethnic group even existed. Afterward, as the flight to Cambodia gained altitude, Obama came to see me. "That was worth doing," he said. He looked out the window. "It's interesting how the place feels frozen in time. It reminds me of what Jakarta looked like when I lived there. Now it's just high-rises. They'd be smart to preserve some of what makes this part of the world different." Our time in Cambodia would be dominated by the Middle East. For the second time in the immediate aftermath of an Obama election, Israel was at war in Gaza, and we were working to secure a ceasefire. I had to pull Obama from a gala dinner in Phnom Penh so that he could talk to Mohamed Morsi, the recently elected Egyptian president. Morsi was the leader of the Muslim Brotherhood, which had close ties to Hamas. Obama was pressing him to use his influence to get Hamas to stop firing rockets into Israel, and Morsi was eager to show that he could deliver. Back at the hotel, before going to bed, Obama told us that we should wake him if Morsi wanted to talk again. The Situation Room called me after midnight to say that Morsi was asking to speak to Obama. Tom Donilon was asleep, so for the first time, I had to go into Obama's suite to wake him up. Wearing sweatpants and a t-shirt, he gave me a strong shove on the way to the phone, feigning anger. He sat there cradling the phone, taking notes and coaching Morsi through the assurances that were necessary from Hamas in order to get a ceasefire. When he hung up, he asked me to set up a meeting with Hillary first thing the next morning. He was going to send her to Israel and Egypt to conclude a ceasefire. It was after 2. I went to my room and lay in bed staring at the ceiling. I was entering a new role as one of the only constants in the second term, the kind of person who could wake him up to take a call from the Egyptian president. The trip to Burma represented the opportunity to make our own priorities, and yet, because of my communications responsibilities, I would always find myself pulled, as if by gravity, to crises. Could I really handle 2 or 4 more years of this storm chasing? I closed my eyes to find a little sleep, but kept getting woken up by the whine of a mosquito flying in circles around me. I swatted at the air as the minutes turned into hours, drifting into and out of a fitful sleep, not remembering whether Morsi had called, whether I'd have to get up again to do something, what I could not remember, until I woke at the first light of dawn to find the mosquito exploded in a pool of my own blood on the pillow next to me. On the flight home, Obama was calling different aides up to the front of the plane to talk about what they wanted to do in a second term. Samantha, who would become ambassador to the United Nations. Mike Froman, who would become U.S. Trade Representative. White House colleagues who were poised to become cabinet members. Obama was in his office, having changed into casual clothes, and asked me to sit next to him on the couch. "So, have you thought at all about the second term?" he asked. "Not really," I said. "Is there anything else you want to do?" "No," I said. "But I don't want to be miserable in the job I have." I didn't know if I was referring to the frustration with the lack of ambition in our policies, or the sense of fatigue at the mix of responsibilities, some large, some mundane, that I carried with me, planning the schedule, writing the speeches, briefing the press on the worst event happening in the world. The white noise of the plane hummed in the background. "I feel like we're just too afraid of our own shadow sometimes," I said. "We have to be." Referring to Donilon, he said, "Tom has to worry about a car bomb going off in Times Square, or an ambassador getting killed." I started to complain about the process. We weren't pressing an affirmative agenda, taking on issues like Cuba that I knew Obama wanted to get to. It began to feel as though I was complaining about Donilon and McDonough, which wasn't my point. "I'm tired of just being the guy who defends drones." Obama read me quickly. "So, more Cuba, less killing," he said. "Look, I feel you. We've got 4 more years now. We've got a lot to get done. Why don't you think about a couple of projects you'd like to take on? Issues where you can take the lead." "That sounds good," I said. "We can keep talking about this, but I'd like you to stay where you are." He paused. "You're not just an advisor. You're a friend." "Thanks," I said. I wasn't sure what to say. He started to talk about other staff changes that he was mulling, how to replace Favreau and a few other key people, and then he went back to the conference room to play cards. I returned to my seat and closed my eyes. Back when I worked for Lee Hamilton, one of his longtime staffers had warned me always to remember, in Washington, when you work for someone, you're staff, no matter how close you get to your boss. I had begun to drift asleep when a hand shook me awake. Obama had spoken to Morsi again, and I'd have to brief the press at the back of the plane. Even friends, after all, are staff. Chapter 16. Young men wage war. Old men make peace. In the fall of 2012, a proposal made its way to Obama recommending that he provide military support to the Syrian opposition. In the years that followed, this proposal would take on mythical status as a road not taken that could have led to a different outcome. The reality is that it was a small-scale recommendation to engage a portion of the opposition, providing them with a fraction of the support that Russia and Iran were providing to the Assad regime. David Petraeus, by that time the director of the CIA, pushed for it. He was also honest about what it was and wasn't. "This won't change the direction of the war," he'd say. "It will allow us to build relationships with the opposition." I was ambivalent. Over the course of the fall, I'd fought a losing battle against those who wanted to designate part of the Syrian opposition, al-Nusra, as a terrorist organization. Al-Nusra was probably the strongest fighting force within the opposition, and while there were extremist elements in the group, it was also clear that the more moderate opposition was fighting side by side with al-Nusra. I argued that labeling al-Nusra as terrorists would alienate the same people we wanted to help, while giving al-Nusra less incentive to avoid extremist affiliations. It spoke to the schizophrenia in American foreign policy that we were simultaneously debating whether to designate the Syrian opposition as terrorists and whether to provide military support to the Syrian opposition. And it spoke to the hubris in American foreign policy to think that we could engineer the Syrian opposition, whom we barely knew and who were fighting for their lives, through terrorist designations and some modest military support. I also argued that if we were going to intervene in Syria's civil war, we should do so with our own military. From Central America to Afghanistan, America didn't have a great track record with arming proxies. If we thought it was worth tipping the balance against Assad, we should be debating whether to strike his regime directly. I pressed this point in a few meetings in late 2012 and early 2013, but I was usually the only person doing so other than Jake and Samantha. In one meeting early in the second term, Obama went around the room as he normally did when he wanted to test the status quo of his policies. Jake and I were sitting together on the back bench, and when it got to us, we made versions of the same argument. "If things keep deteriorating," I said, "we should consider bombing Assad's runways, or we should consider limited strikes against some regime infrastructure." I spoke the words, but they felt hollow. Obama seemed to listen passively, not making eye contact, rubbing his forehead as I spoke. It was wrenching to read about the brutality of Assad every morning, to see images of family homes reduced to rubble. I felt we had to do something in Syria. I'd aligned myself in 2011 with a bet on the people in the streets, from Tunis to Cairo, from Tripoli to Damascus. But by early 2013, I felt I was playing a part, the advocate for action, and couldn't muster the same passion that I had during the Libya debate. What difference would it make to bomb runways? That was a point I'd picked up from other advocates for action, but I couldn't answer the question Obama posed in response. "And what happens after we bomb the runways and Russia, Iran, and Assad rebuild them?" After the meeting, McDonough took to calling Jake and me Cheney and Rumsfeld. One morning, early in the second term, Obama sat in the Roosevelt Room to meet with a small group of journalists that I'd assembled. It was not unusual to invite a handful of columnists or commentators in to meet the president, usually off the record. This time, though, was different, as I invited a handful of people who weren't usually included in these sessions, people who spent most of their time reporting in the Middle East and who were largely sympathetic to the protesters who were pushing for change. Instead of aiming to influence them, I was hoping their stories could have some impact on Obama, pressing him to be more assertive in Syria and across the region. One after another, they offered an unvarnished view of the chaos engulfing the region, and Syria in particular. The trends were not good. Opposition movements were becoming more extremist. Iran was doubling down on its support for Assad in Syria. Gulf countries were funding groups in Syria and Libya that were more militant than the United States wanted. Most of them argued that the United States was failing to shape events, though I noticed that the most senior correspondent lacked any hope that events could be shaped. Obama listened intently, asking questions as much as he offered his own opinions. When the session was over, I followed him into the Oval Office, where I quickly realized that the session had had the opposite of the effect I intended. Where I heard a call to action, Obama had heard a cautionary tale. How could the United States fix a part of the world that was that broken, and that decades of U.S. foreign policy had helped to break? Sensing my unease, he asked me what I thought. "We're 60% pregnant across the region," I said, and ticked off a list of complaints that I'd been keeping in my head over the last year. "We're half in on Middle East peace, on Syria, on Egypt, on the pursuit of a nuclear agreement with Iran. We have to go big." He asked me to follow him back to his private dining room, where we could continue the conversation while he ate lunch. There on the wall was a painting of Lincoln, deep in thought, consulting Grant at the height of the Civil War. A photo of Obama meeting Nelson Mandela. A pair of boxing gloves used by Muhammad Ali. Obama sat at the table while I remained standing. I worried that I was overstepping my bounds. "On Middle East peace," he told me, "he had tried repeatedly, but Bibi wouldn't make a deal. On Syria, he kept asking for them, but there were no good options. And on Iran," he said, "what do you want me to do? Give a speech offering to recognize their right to enrich uranium in return for easing sanctions?" "It's not so much one thing," I said. "We just need to be more opportunistic, to go big where we can." I reminded him of the limo ride back from the Libya speech, when he'd said he wished he had the bandwidth to focus on the Arab Spring. "What would we do with that bandwidth?" I asked. "Sir," I continued, with unusual formality, "this is a seismic geopolitical shift and social movement. It's taking place up here." I held my hand up by my head. "But our actions are down here." I lowered my hand to my waist.
"Maybe that's right," he said. "But we can't fool ourselves into thinking that we can fix the Middle East."
He paused, chewing. "I love that you care this much. But what's the line from Lawrence of Arabia?" he said. It was a movie we frequently quoted to each other. "Young men make wars, then old men make the peace." Despite his misgivings, Obama decided that the first foreign trip of his second term would be to Israel and Jordan. Throughout his first term, we had waited to make our first visit to Israel, thinking that we would go when there was an opening in the peace process. 4 years in, it was clear that an opening might never come. Obama had been criticized repeatedly throughout the election for not having visited Israel. Now, he decided, it was time to go. I spent weeks preparing an itinerary, one that might encompass the full breadth of Israeli history, the Israel Museum, to demonstrate the historical Jewish connection to the land, Herzl's tomb, to pay tribute to Zionism, Yad Vashem, the Holocaust Museum, Rabin's grave, to honor Israel's martyred peacemaker, an exposition on entrepreneurship, to showcase Israel's burgeoning startup culture. I worked on the schedule with Israel's ambassador to the United States, Michael Oren, who had been a harsh critic of Obama but wanted the visit to go well and seemed reconciled to 4 more years of a Democratic White House. In multiple conversations, he encouraged me to have Obama visit a village of Ethiopian Jews. I demurred, a little put off by this persistent suggestion that Obama would want to see black Jews more than others. In the receiving line in front of Air Force One, Bibi told Obama that he was familiar with me from cables. Obama told him that my brother ran CBS News. "Ben has a proud Jewish mother," he said. Bibi chose to focus on my connection to CBS, not Judaism. "Sounds incestuous," he said. "Not if you watch CBS News," Obama replied. For me, the trip was filled with conflicting emotions. Working on Obama's speech, I felt a bit like a bystander, aware of my own half-heritage, neither full Jew nor non-Jew. Israel's history is in no way normal, and its security concerns are rooted in a history of anti-Semitism that continues to the current day. At the same time,
I had to confront the intractability of the Palestinian predicament as I wrote the latest appeal for peace, knowing it would likely fall on deaf ears. The morning of the speech, we flew by helicopter to Ramallah to meet with Mahmoud Abbas. I looked out at rolling hills and could see where Israeli settlements were splitting the West Bank in two. We were in the air for less than 10 minutes, but the contrast could not have been starker. Israel from the air resembles southern Europe. The settlements looked like subdivisions in the Nevada desert. The Palestinian towns looked shabby and choked off. After a long meeting with Abbas, Obama met with a group of young Palestinians in a small classroom. Each took turns speaking and had a wrenching story of occupation. I noticed one boy, about 18, who looked the most agitated throughout the meeting, staring at his hands while the others spoke. He was last to speak, and when his turn came, he told similar stories of friends imprisoned, freedom of movement restricted. Finally, he built up to a line that he had clearly practiced. "Mr. President, we are treated the same way the black people were treated in your country. Here, in this century." He paused and let a pregnant silence hang over the table. "Funded by your government, Mr. President." Obama looked drained. He had no good answer for the kid, so he didn't bother faking it. He talked about how much promise they had, how he hoped young Palestinians could get a higher profile in the United States. He defended Israel, saying that the Jewish people had a right to be concerned about their security. He ended on the most optimistic note he could find, how young people gave him hope, how they reminded him of his own daughters, how Israeli mothers should be able to see them and hear their stories because they would understand. Often, when Obama was frustrated by governments, he'd talk about their people. We took the helicopter back to Jerusalem, and I sent the final draft of the speech to the teleprompter from my BlackBerry. Backstage at the convention center, he started talking about how tough the meeting had been. "That last kid seemed like he got his courage up," I said. "Yes," Obama said. "It took a lot of guts for him to do that." He told me a story that the former Palestinian Prime Minister, Salman Fayyad, had told him about how the Israelis parked a car in front of his office every few days and sat there watching him. "It's not about security," Fayyad had said. "It's about power." "Well," I said, "that makes our theory more necessary. Show the Israelis you love them, but also challenge them." "That's your theory," he said. "The Ben Rhodes theory." Obama, who was often accused of putting too much stock in speeches, was more cynical than I about the capacity for a speech to change entrenched attitudes, particularly a conflict as intractable as the Israeli-Palestinian one. I watched the speech backstage on the teleprompter. Obama paused for a moment, and I saw the text freeze. "I'm going off script here for a second," he said. "But before I came here, I met with a group of young Palestinians from the age of 15 to 22. And talking to them, they weren't that different from my daughters. They weren't that different from your daughters or sons. I honestly believe that if any Israeli parent sat down with those kids, they'd say, 'I want these kids to succeed. I want them to prosper. I want them to have opportunities just like my kids do.' I believe that's what Israeli parents would want for these kids if they had a chance to listen to them and talk to them. I believe that." His comments were met with rolling applause, and when he dived back into the prepared text, it occurred to me that this tribute, this imploring of Israelis to see Palestinians as human beings no different from themselves, might be the most he would be able to do to keep a promise to those Palestinian kids. That night, at a dinner hosted by Shimon Peres, I sat next to his daughter, an older woman who spoke accented English and could have fit in at the Seders I went to as a kid. She recounted the story of how her family had hid throughout the Holocaust, the pride they felt upon reaching Israel, the imperative of bringing the nearly dead language of Hebrew back to life. It evoked in me a sense of pride at what Israelis had accomplished over the last 70 years, but it was also hard to reconcile that sense of history, generosity, and justice with those Palestinian kids. Obama's vision, so readily accepted by young people everywhere, including the young Israelis in the convention center, seemed to clash with the harder edges of politics, the world in which one side needs to win and another needs to lose. The hopeful chapter that began with the spread of the Arab Spring to Egypt in 2011 came to an end during a trip that we took to Africa in June 2013. In Tanzania, Obama called Mohamed Morsi from a secure room in his hotel as protests against the Egyptian government were again building in the streets. This time, we had indications that the Egyptian military, backed by the Saudi and Emirati governments, was stoking the unrest, preparing the overthrow of the deeply flawed yet democratically elected government. They were also sponsoring an information campaign against the U.S. ambassador, Ann Patterson, casting her as an accomplice of the Muslim Brotherhood. It was a way to apply pressure on us, to demonstrate that this time they weren't going to yield in their intention to see the type of government they wanted in Cairo just because of America's views. In one of the more brazen acts that I'd experienced in my job, the Emirati ambassador to the United States, Youssef Al-Otaiba, a man treated as a leading voice on the affairs of the region in the corridors of power in Washington, sent me a photo of a poster that cast Patterson in this light with no other message attached. Morsi sounded tired but defiant as Obama spoke to him from the makeshift NSC office. Obama urged him to do something to reach out to his growing opposition, some gesture at a unity government that could hold the country together. "You know," he said, "I just left South Africa, where Nelson Mandela is in the hospital and is very sick. You know, when he came to power, he could have gone to the white minority in South Africa and said, 'We are now the majority, and we're going to do what we want. We'll follow the rules, but you are a small minority in this country.' But he didn't do this. He went out of his way to reach out to the minority. He even put his former prison guard, the man who had been the warden of the prison where he had been held, in charge of the security services. It was those gestures that showed he was about bringing the country together and sending the message that, in fact, everyone is part of this thing. You are not just the head of the Muslim Brotherhood. You are the president of Egypt. You need to listen to everyone, and your cabinet needs to be reflective of everyone. And the rules and the Constitution include everyone." Morsi kept reiterating his democratic legitimacy, the fact that he'd won an election. But he also grew reflective, a man who knew his time might be running out. "My background was in physics," he told Obama, "but I also know Egypt very well." In contrast to the undemocratic steps he'd taken to try to alter Egypt's constitution, Morsi said, "I'm doing my best to write history for a new Egypt that is really democratic, and what I want to see in my life is that power is transferred in elections to another candidate." A few days later, Morsi was toppled in a military takeover of the government and put into prison, where he remains to this day. A general, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, took power, casting himself as a savior of Egypt from Islamists with the full backing of Saudi Arabia and the UAE, two U.S. allies that had actively subverted democracy and worked against U.S. policy. In Washington, a tortured debate ensued about whether to label what had been clearly a coup, which would entail restrictions on the type of assistance that we provide to the Egyptian government. In meetings, once again, I was in a small minority of people arguing on behalf of democracy in Egypt, saying that we should label it a coup for the sake of our credibility. I lost the argument, and I didn't press the point. As with intervention in Syria, my heart wasn't entirely in it anymore. I could tell which way the argument was going to go, and which way events were going. Obama was the most powerful man in the world. But that didn't mean he could control the forces at play in the Middle East. There was no Nelson Mandela who could lead a country to absolution for its sins and ours. Extremist forces were exploiting the Arab Spring. Reactionary forces, with deep reservoirs of political support in the United States, were intent on clinging to power. Bashar al-Assad was going to fight to the death, backed by his Russian and Iranian sponsors. Factions were going to fight it out in the streets of Libya. The Saudis and Emiratis were going to stamp out political dissent in Egypt before it could come to their kingdoms. A Likud prime minister was going to mouth words about peace while building settlements that made peace impossible. Meanwhile, innocent people were going to suffer. Some of them were going to be killed, and there didn't seem to be anything I could do about it. Obama had reached that conclusion before I had. History had opened up a doorway in 2011 that, by the middle of 2013, had been slammed shut. There would be more war, more conflict, and more suffering until, someday, old men would make peace. Part 3. Change. 2013 to 2014. Chapter 17. Clenched Fists. After my conversation with Obama on Air Force One, I'd thought about the question he had posed. Why don't you think about a couple of projects you'd like to take on? I began to keep a file in my head of what I called the affirmative agenda, issues where we could be doing more. Cuba, Colombia, Burma, exchange programs, development in Africa, places where a little investment from the United States might make a positive difference. I told McDonough, who was poised to become chief of staff. Then we had a meeting with Obama before the inauguration where we went through a thick briefing that reviewed all of the things that we might do in a second term. Obama stopped on Cuba. "Let's see what we can do here," he said. "But we'll have to get Alan Gross out of prison." Alan Gross was a 63-year-old American USAID subcontractor who had already spent 3 years in a Cuban prison. He was arrested in December 2009 while delivering satellite and communications equipment to Cuba's small Jewish community and accused of spying. Before Gross's arrest, we had made some incremental changes in our Cuba policy, such as expanding the capacity for Cuban Americans to travel and send remittances to the island. The Cuban government had also initiated some reforms, including allowing for the emergence of a small private sector so that people could own their own shops, restaurants, and taxis. This created an opening for American travel and money to flow directly to Cubans, without getting caught in the net of the U.S. embargo. But Gross's unjust arrest made it impossible to press forward with further changes. As the State Department pursued Gross's release, the Cubans insisted that he be exchanged for 4 Cubans imprisoned in the United States. These prisoners were part of the so-called Cuban Five, or WASP, network, a ring of spies arrested after Cuba shot down 2 small airplanes that were dropping leaflets into Cuba in the 1990s, killing 4 people. The only way to get Gross out of prison and set the stage for broader changes was through sustained diplomacy, but we had no formal diplomatic relations with Cuba. The U.S. Congress had a handful of well-placed hardliners who were dead set against improving relations, including Cuban-Americans Bob Menendez, the Democratic chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and Republican Marco Rubio. Meanwhile, the Cubans did not trust the State Department, which had spent decades trying to isolate Cuba and channel assistance to opponents of the Cuban government. If we were going to talk, it was going to have to be done secretly. I was largely a bystander on Cuba issues in the first term, but I had grown frustrated by the status quo. Every time we traveled to Latin America, our summits were dominated by complaints about our Cuba policy. There was zero evidence that our hardline approach was doing anything to advance human rights. Obama himself told me repeatedly that he was unhappy with our Cuba policy and wanted to change it. U.S. interests, common sense, and honesty suggested this was something we should change. In Obama's first inaugural address, he had said, "To those who cling to power through corruption and deceit and the silencing of dissent, know that you are on the wrong side of history, but that we will extend a hand if you are willing to unclench your fist." I wanted to test whether we could make that connection with Cuba. The lead staffer on Latin America at the White House was Ricardo Zuniga, a 42-year-old foreign service officer who was a leading Cuba expert in the government. Born in Honduras to a politically prominent family, he moved to the United States amid the upheaval that plagued Central America. After his father was murdered in Honduras in 1985, Ricardo's family stayed in the United States. He had served as the human rights officer in Havana from 2002 to 2004 and spent much of his time trying to meet with opponents of the Castro government. Later, he was on the Cuba desk at State when Gross was arrested in 2009. Ricardo also found himself the consistent target of Cuban government propaganda, derided on state television and trailed by Cuban agents. Unbeknownst to me, he'd been developing a plan to pursue a secret channel with the Cuban government and shake up the status quo. Shortly after the Situation Room meeting in which Obama signaled an interest in doing something on Cuba, McDonough asked me to go for a walk, which he often did when he wanted to have a conversation that touched upon something personal. His looming promotion to chief of staff felt as though it could open a bit of a chasm in our friendship. We'd known each other since 2002. He was my oldest friend in the White House. But soon he would be among the most powerful people in the country. In the future, when we'd go for walks, we'd be trailed by Secret Service agents. The southwest gate of the White House clanged, and we started to walk around the ellipse that curves around the south side of the White House grounds, tourists snapping pictures of themselves with the long, sloping lawn in the background. He began to explain that he thought it would probably be too much for me to take on everything in my affirmative agenda file. Before I could say anything in response, he said, "Why don't you do Cuba?" "I want to do Cuba," I said in response. "No, I mean, why don't you actually do Cuba?" he said. "Someone is going to have to open up a channel with the Cubans and negotiate Alan Gross's release. Ricardo's been working up a plan, but we need someone senior to lead it." "You mean do the negotiation myself?" I asked. I had just thought about running some meetings on Cuba policy. "I haven't done anything like that." "We're going to need someone close to the president to do this," he said. I started to feel some nerves in my stomach. I couldn't say no, but it wasn't what I thought I'd be saying yes to, and I couldn't even envision what this would be. Diplomacy with whom, when, where? "Okay," I said. "Yes." "Great," he said. "You should mention it to POTUS next time you talk to him, and then get with Ricardo." McDonough had a style like this, a way of rewarding you while challenging you. Obama was doing the same thing with him. He was about to become chief of staff, the man in charge of the president's domestic policy agenda, and he'd held only national security jobs. "Why don't you do Cuba?" I didn't want to betray that I was nervous, that I might not know how to do this. The only thing I knew for sure about Cuba was that every effort to improve relations so far had failed. My conversation with Obama was brief and came in the context of his asking me if I'd figured out what my wish list for a second term was. "Dennis talked to me about leading Cuba policy and doing the negotiations," I said. "I know," he said. "It's a good idea. Our man in Havana." Over the next few weeks, I started to meet with Ricardo, who had a straightforward plan. We'd propose a dialogue with the Cubans on Alan Gross and counterterrorism. That way, if the effort leaked, no one could object. But our hope was that we'd get traction and gradually expand the dialogue to address deeper issues in the relationship. In May 2013, we sent a short message to the Cubans proposing a meeting. It was the first test of whether the Cubans wanted to pursue engagement, and we didn't know what we'd get in response. "Who shows up for them is what really matters," Ricardo said. It wasn't a foregone conclusion that they'd respond favorably. For decades, the Cuban government had built its legitimacy in part on opposition to the United States. It was a guiding principle of Cuba's foreign policy, and a justification for cracking down on dissent at home. Improved relations with the United States would undercut that narrative. Advocates for engagement weren't subtle in arguing that more travel, more commerce, and more connections between the United States and Cuba would help the Cuban people while also catalyzing reforms on the island. It would also dramatically improve the standing of the United States in Latin America. A few days after we sent the message, Ricardo came to see me. He liked to do everything in person. "We got a message back, and it's serious," he said. Alejandro Castro, Raúl Castro's son, would lead the delegation, which agreed to meet with us in Canada. Up to that point, Alejandro had been a bit of a mystery in the United States. His titles were colonel and chair of something called the Cuban National Security and Defense Commission, a relatively new creation modeled in part on the American NSC. By all accounts, he was playing a larger role in the Cuban system, but nobody knew exactly what that meant. Most analysts thought he was the most powerful man in Cuba after Raúl and Fidel. I could speak for Obama, and there was no doubt that he would speak for his father. The Canadians had graciously agreed to host us, and when Ricardo and I landed in Ottawa, we were met at the gate by a pudgy man who made sure we got through immigration with no problem and escorted us to a waiting van. We asked no questions and were driven through a sun-splashed June day into the surrounding countryside, with empty roads rolling through dense forest. The Canadians had taken our request for discretion seriously. In a flat Canadian accent, the driver peppered us with trivia about Ottawa and the vacationing habits of people in this region, as if we were visiting tourists, before driving through a gate and up a winding driveway to a house with a large wraparound porch, which looked out over a lake dotted with the occasional kayak or fisherman. We were shown into a room with a long table that looked as if it could seat at least 20 people. I took my things out of a backpack, a spiral notebook, a binder with talking points that anticipated the several hours of discussion. I was anxious, tired from waking before dawn to make the flight, and nervous because I had no idea where this was leading. I sipped from a water bottle and waited there to begin the highest-level negotiations between the governments of the United States and Cuba in decades. Alejandro breezed into the room, trailed by three other Cubans, and took my hand with both of his, greeting me like an old friend. He was a big man who spoke and laughed loudly. Befitting the sense of mystery that comes with all things Cuban, he had apparently lost vision in one eye in a training accident while serving in Angola. With slightly thinning hair and black wire-rimmed glasses, he looked more like an academic than a colonel. In fact, he'd spent the previous years publishing works of history, including screeds against American imperialism and full-throated defenses of the Cuban Revolution. He introduced the rest of his party, but the other two men barely spoke. One of them was older, with a permanent frown, the look of a man who had done many things on behalf of the Cuban security services over the years. The other was younger, spoke good English, and seemed to have a boundless curiosity about us. The interpreter was an elegant older woman named Juana, who conveyed an air of having seen everything. And she had. She'd been Fidel's translator for more than 30 years. Alejandro began by saying that Cuba wanted this to be an open channel of communication. He gestured at the stoic older man sitting next to him, who had participated in back-channel conversations with Americans in the 1990s, saying they'd learned from the past. He noted that Obama was respected in Cuba and in Latin America, and emphasized that Raúl did not want to damage Obama's political capital. Instead, he wanted to offer him political space to improve the relationship. I responded in kind, saying that we wanted to maintain the channel as well, and we hoped we could make progress on securing the release of Alan Gross, deepening counterterrorism cooperation, and improving the U.S.-Cuba relationship. We had a somewhat forced discussion about terrorism. Cuba wasn't exactly an Al-Qaeda target, and Cuban security services weren't exactly lax. Then the history lesson began, as Alejandro offered a review of U.S.-based terrorism against Cuba. In a methodical tone, almost matter-of-fact, as if it was a common dinner-table topic in Cuba, We heard a detailed review of the last 60 years. The Bay of Pigs invasion. The CIA's attempts to assassinate Fidel, more than 600 by their count. Rumors of Cuban-American complicity in the assassination of John F. Kennedy. A Luis Posada Carillas, Cuban-born and CIA-trained,